How did the storm sneak up on you then?
I don't know, Barak. Maybe it's not a natural storm. Some wizard may have summoned it. I don't know if my leg would react to something like that.
That's always an easy excuse, Drolag, Barak scoffed. Any time an ignorant man can't explain something, he blames it on magic.
I don't have to take this, Barak, Drolag said hotly. I earn my way, but I'm not responsible for supernatural forces.
Go below, Drolag. Have a long talk with your leg, and see if it can come up with a better excuse.
Drolag staggered down the pitching deck, talking to himself. Barak was in a foul humor. Everything seemed to be conspiring to delay him. Not long after he and his friends had witnessed Agachak's unpleasant demise, Seabird had struck a submerged log and sprung a seam. It had only been by dint of Herculean paling that they had been able to limp downriver to Dalazerba and to haul the leaky ship up onto a mud bar for repairs. That chore had cost them 2 weeks, and now this storm from nowhere added to the delay. Then Unrak came up from below, trailed by the dull-faced king of the tolls. Unrak looked around with the wind clawing at his bright red hair.
"It doesn't seem to be letting up, does it, father?" he observed.
"Not noticeably."
"Hetta wants to talk with you."
"I've got to steer this big brute."
"The mate can do it, father. All he has to do is keep her bow into the wind. Hethor's been studying that map, and he thinks we're in danger."
"From this little storm? Don't be silly."
"Is Seabird's bottom strong enough to take on rocks?"
"We are in deep water."
"Not for long, I don't think. Just come below, father. Hethor can show you."
Grumbling, Barak turned the tiller over to the first mate and followed his son to the companionway leading below. Nathal, the king of the tolls, trailed along behind them, his face incurious. Nathal was a bit older than Unrak, but he had taken to following Barak's red-haired son about like a stray puppy. Unrak was none too gracious to his unwanted companion.
"What's this all about, Hetar?"
Barak demanded of his friend as he entered the cramped cabin.
"Come over here and have a look," the tall Algar said.
Barak strode over to the bolted-down table and looked down at the map.
"We left Dalazerba yesterday morning, right?"
"Yes. We'd have gotten away sooner if somebody had been paying attention to what was lying under the surface of that river. I think I'll find out who was on bow watch that day and have him keel-hauled."
"What's keel-hauled?"
Nathal asked Unrak.
"Something very unpleasant," the red-haired boy replied.
"I dread you didn't tell me then. I don't like unpleasant stuff."
"Whatever you want, Your Majesty."
Unrak did have a few manners.
"Couldn't you just call me Nathal?"
the toll asked plaintively.
"I'm not really king anyway. Mother's the one who makes all the decisions."
"Anything you want, Nathal."
Unrak said it with a certain pity.
"How far would you estimate? We have come since yesterday,"
Hetar asked Barak.
"Oh, maybe 20 leagues. We had to heave to last night because we're in strange waters."
"It puts us almost right here, doesn't it?"
Hetar pointed at an ominous symbol on the map.
"We aren't anywhere near that reef, Hetar. We came about to the southeast as soon as we came out of that estuary at the mouth of the river."
"But we haven't been going southeast, Barak. There seems to be a current that comes down along the west coast of Meloria. And it is a fairly strong one. I have checked a few times. Your bow is pointed southeast, but the Seabird
has been drifting sideways, almost due south, because of that current.
When did you suddenly become such an expert on sailing?
I don't have to be, Barak. Take a stick of wood and throw it off your starboard side. Your ship will catch up with the stick in just a few minutes.
We are definitely drifting south, in spite of whichever direction your bow is pointed.
I would guess that within an hour, we'll be able to hear the surf breaking on that reef.
I do confirm that our friends speaketh truth, my lord of Trelheim,
Mandarallan assured him.
I myself have witnessed his experiment with the stick. Truly we are tending southward.
What can we do?
Leldoran asked a bit apprehensively. Barak stared gloomily at the map.
We don't have any choice, he said. We can't get back out into open sea in this storm. We will have to drop both anchors and hope that we can find a bottom that will hold us. Then we sit tight and ride it out. What is the name of that reef, Etar?
Turim,
the Algar replied.
Chapter 20. Like almost every other ship's cabin in all the world, the one on Captain Kreska's vessel was low and had dark-stained beams overhead. The furniture was bolted to the floor, and oil lamps swung from the beams as the ship, swinging at anchor, rolled heavily in the combers coming in off of the Sea of the East. Garion rather liked being at sea. There was a calmness, a kind of suspension of care, out on deep water. When he was ashore, it seemed that he was always scurrying from place to place through crowds of people, all filling his ears with distractions. At sea, however, there was time to be alone with his thoughts, and the even, patient roll of waves and the slow movement of the sky made those thoughts long and deep. Their evening meal had been simple, a hearty bean soup and thick slices of dark, rich bread, and they sat on the benches around the plain table after they had eaten, talking idly, and awaiting the arrival of the captain, who had promised to join them as soon as he had secured his ship. The half-grown wolf lay under the table near where Tsenedra sat, and his eyes had a studied, pleading look in them. Tsenedra slipped him tidbits when she thought no one was watching her. Wolves are not stupid, after all.
The surf seems to be heavy,
Zakath said, cocking his head to one side to listen to the booming of the waves against the rocks of the reef.
It's likely to cause some problems when we try to land, isn't it?
I rather doubt it, Belgarath said. This storm has probably been brewing since the day the earth was made. It is not going to interfere with us in any way.
Aren't you being just a little fatalistic, Belgarath? Belden suggested. And perhaps slightly overconfident?
I don't think so. The two prophecies must have this meeting. They have been coming toward this place since the beginning of time. They are not going to let anything interfere with the arrival of anyone who is supposed to be here.
Why raise a storm like this, then?
The storm was not designed to hinder us or Zandramas.
What is its purpose?
It's probably out there to keep others away. There are only certain people who are supposed to be on that reef tomorrow. The prophecies are going to see to it that no one else can set foot on it until after our business has been completed. Garion looked at Sierrathus. The blindfolded girl's face was calm, even serene. The half-concealment of the strip of cloth across her eyes had always at least partially concealed her features from him. In this light, however, he suddenly realized just how extraordinarily beautiful she really was.
That raises something rather interesting, Grandfather. Sierrathus, didn't you tell us that the Child of Dark has always been solitary? Doesn't that mean that she'll have to face us alone tomorrow?
Thou hast misread my meaning, Belgarian of Riva. Thou and each of thy companions have had your names writ large in the stars since the beginning of days. Those who will accompany the Child of Dark, however, are of no moment. Their names do not stand in the Book of the Heavens. Zandramas is the only emissary of the Dark Prophecy of any significance. The others she will bring with her were doubtless chosen at random, and their numbers are limited to match your force. A fair fight, then,
Velvet murmured approvingly.
I think we can probably cope.
That doesn't bode too well for me, though, Belden said. Back at Rehun, you rather carefully listed the people who were supposed to come here with Garion. As I recall, my name was not on the list. Do you suppose they forgot to send me an invitation?
Nay, gentle Belden, thy presence here is necessary now. Zandramas hath included in her forces one who is beyond the prophecies. Thou art here to offset that one, though in numbers only.
Zandramas can't ever play a game without cheating, can she? Silk said.
Can you?
Velvet asked him. Oh, that's different. I'm only playing for worthless counters, bits and pieces of unimportant metal. The stakes in this game are a lot higher. The cabin door opened, and Captain Kreska entered with several rolls of parchment under his arm. He had changed out of his doublet, and now wore a tar-stained canvas seacoat and no hat. Garion saw that his short-cropped hair was as silvery as Belgarath's, a startling contrast to his deeply tanned and weathered face.
"The storm seems to be abating," he announced. "At least around the reef it is. I don't think I've ever seen a storm like this." "I would be surprised if you had, Captain," Belden told him. "As closely as we can determine, this is the first one, and probably the last, of its kind." "I think you're wrong, friend," Captain Kreska disagreed. "There's nothing new in the way of weather in the world. It has all happened before."
"Just let it lie," Belgarath said quietly to Belden. "He is a Malsine. He's not really prepared for this sort of thing."
"All right," the captain said, pushing their soup bowls out of the way and laying his charts on the table. "We are there," he pointed. "Now, which part of the reef was it you proposed to land on?"
"The highest pinnacle," Belgarath told him. Kreska sighed.
"I might have known. That's the one part of the reef where my charts aren't too accurate. About the time I got to taking soundings around that one, a squall came out of nowhere, and I had to back off."
He thought about it.
"No matter. We will stand a half mile or so offshore and go in with the longboat. There's something you ought to know about that part of the reef, though."
"Oh?"
"I think there are some people there."
"I sort of doubt it."
"I don't really know of any other creature that builds fires, do you? There's a cave on the north side of that pinnacle, and sailors have been seeing the light of fires coming out of the mouth of it for years now. It's my guess that there's a band of pirates living in there. It wouldn't be all that hard for them to come out in small boats on dark nights and waylay merchantmen in the straits on the landward side of the reef."
"Can you see the fire from where we are right now?" Garion asked him.
"I would guess so. Let's go topside and have a look."
The ladies, Sadi and Toth, remained in the cabin, and Garion and his other friends followed Captain Kreska up the companionway to the deck. The wind, which had been howling through the rigging when the sailors had dropped anchor, had fallen off, and the surf along the reef was no longer frothy.
"There," Kreska said, pointing. It's not quite as visible from this angle, but you can make it out. When you're standing out to sea from the cave mouth, it's really bright.
Dimly, Geryon could see a sooty red glow a short way up the side of a bulky-looking peak jutting up out of the sea. The other rocks that formed the reef appeared to be little more than slender spires. But the central peak had a different shape. For some reason, it reminded Geryon of the truncated mountain that was the site of far-off Prolgu in Olgoland.
Nobody has ever explained to my satisfaction how the top of that mountain got sliced off like that,
Kreska said.
It's probably a very long story,
Silk told him. The little man shivered.
It is still a little chilly out here. Why don't we go below again?
Geryon fell back to walk beside Belgarath.
What is making that light, Grandfather?
He asked quietly.
I'm not entirely sure,
Belgarath replied.
But I think it might be the Sardian. We know it is in that cave.
We do?
Of course we do. At the time of the meeting, the orb and the Sardian have to come into each other's presence in the same way you and Zandramos do. That Melsin's scholar who stole the Sardian, the one Sinjay told us about, sailed around the southern tip of Gandahar and disappeared into these waters. That was all too convenient to be mere coincidence. The Sardian was controlling the scholar, and the scholar delivered the stone to the precise place it wanted to go. It has probably been waiting for us in that cave for about 500 years.
Geryon looked back over his shoulder. The hilt of his sword was covered by the leather sleeve, but he was still fairly certain that he would be able to see the muted glow of the orb.
"Doesn't the orb usually react to the presence of the Sardian?"
he asked.
"We may not be close enough yet, and we are still at sea. Open water confuses the orb. Then, too, maybe it's trying to conceal itself from the Sardian."
"Could it actually think its way through that complex an idea? It is usually fairly childish, I've noticed."
"Don't underestimate it, Geryon."
"Everything's fitting together then, isn't it?"
"It all has to, Geryon. Otherwise, what's going to happen tomorrow could not happen."
"Well, father?"
Polgara asked as they re-entered the cabin.
"There is a fire of some kind in that cave, all right,"
he told her. His fingers, however, were telling her something else. "We'll talk about it in more detail after the captain leaves." He turned toward Kreska.
"When is the next low tide?" he asked the seaman.
Kreska squinted, calculating.
"I just missed one," he said. "The tide's coming in now. The next low tide will come about daybreak, and if my observations are correct, it should be a neap tide. Well, I'll leave you to get some rest now. I sort of gather that you've got a full day ahead of you tomorrow."
"Thank you, Captain Kreska,"
Geryon said, shaking the seaman's hand.
"Don't mention it, Geryon,"
Kreska grinned.
"The King of Beldane paid me very handsomely for this voyage, so being helpful doesn't really cost me anything."
"Good," Geryon grinned back. "I like to see friends get ahead in the world."
The captain laughed and went back out with a hearty wave.
"What was he talking about?" Soddy asked. "What's a neap tide?"
"It only happens a few times a year," Belden explained. "It's an extreme low tide. It has to do with the positions of the sun and moon."
"Everything seems to be going out of its way to make tomorrow a very special day," Silk observed.
"All right, father," Polgara said crisply. "What is the story on the fire in that cave?"
"I can't be positive, Paul, but I rather strongly suspect that it's not a group of pirates.
not after all the trouble the prophecies have gone to keep people away from the cave.
What do you think it is, then?
It is probably the Sardian.
Would it give off a red glow?
He shrugged. The orb glows blue. I suppose there's a sort of logic to the Sardians glowing a different color.
Why not green? Silk asked.
Green's an in-between color, Belden told him. It's a mixture of blue and yellow.
You're a real gold mine of useless information. You know that, Belden, Silk said.
There's no such thing as useless information, Kaldar, Belden sniffed.
All right, Zakath said. How are we going to go about this?
Serratus, Belgaroth said to the Seeress,
I'm guessing about this, but I think I'm fairly close. Nobody is going to reach that cave first, are they? What I mean is that the prophecies aren't going to let Zandramos get there before we do, or let us get there first either.
Astounding, Belden murmured. That actually sounded like real logic. Aren't you feeling well, Belgarath?
Would you please? Belgarath growled. Well, Serratus?
She paused, her expression distant. Geryon seemed to hear that faint choral murmuring.
Thy reasoning is correct, Ancient One. The same perception came to Zandramas some time ago. So I am not revealing anything unto thee which she doth not already know. Zandramas, however, hath rejected the fruits of her reasoning, and hath striven to circumvent her conclusions.
Very well, then, Zakath said. Since we are all going to get there at the same time anyway, and since everybody knows about it, there's not much point in being coy, is there? I say we just land on the beach and march straight to the cave.
Stopping only long enough for you and me to put on our armor, Geryon added. It probably wouldn't be a good idea to dress up here on board ship. It might make Kreska nervous.
Your plan sounds good to me, Zakath, Durnik agreed.
I'm not so sure, Silk said dubiously. There is a certain advantage to sneaking.
Thrasnians, Zinedra sighed. Listen to his reasons before you throw the notion out, Zinedra, Velvet suggested.
It's sort of like this, Silk went on. Zandramas knows, deep down, that she can't beat us to that cave. But she's been trying for months all the same, hoping that there's some way she can bypass the rules. Now, let's try to think the way she does.
I would sooner take poison,
Zinedra said with a shudder. It's only for the sake of understanding your opponent, Zinedra. Now, Zandramas has been hoping against hope that she can beat us to that cave and avoid the necessity of coming up against Geryon. He did kill Torak, after all, and nobody in his right mind would willingly confront the Godslayer.
I'm going to have that removed from my title when I get back to Riva, Geryon said sourly.
You can do that later, Silk told him.
What would Zandramas most likely feel if she arrived at the cave mouth, looked around, and didn't see us?
I think I see where you are going, Kaldar, Zadi said admiringly.
You would, Zakath said dryly.
It's really rather brilliant, you know, Kalzakath, the eunuch said. Zandramas is going to feel a wild exultation. She'll believe that she has succeeded in circumventing the prophecies, and that she has won in spite of them.
Then what's going to happen to her when we all step out from behind a boulder and she finds out that she still has to face Geryon and submit to the choice of Serratus after all? Silk asked.
She's probably going to be very disappointed, Velvet said.
I think disappointment might be too mild a term, Silk suggested. I think chagrin might come closer. Couple that with exasperation and a healthy dose of fear, and we will be looking at somebody who's not going to be thinking too clearly. We are fairly sure there's going to be a fight when we get there, and you have always got an advantage in a fight when the opposing general is distracted.
It's sound tactical reasoning, Geryon,
Zakath conceded.
I'll go along with it, Belgarath said. If nothing else, it should give me the opportunity to pay Zandramos back for all of the times that she has upset me. I think I still owe her just a bit for slicing pieces out of the Ashabine oracles. I will talk with Captain Kreska early tomorrow morning and find out if there is a beach on the east side of the peak. With a neap tide, our chances should be pretty good. Then, we'll work our way up along the side of the peak, staying out of sight. We will take cover near the cave mouth and wait for Zandramos to put in an appearance. Then we'll step out and surprise her.
I can add an even bigger advantage, Belden said. I'll scout on ahead and let you know when she lands. That way, you'll be ready for her.
Not as a hawk, though, Uncle, Polgara suggested.
Why not?
Zandramos is not stupid. A hawk would not have any business on that reef. There would not be anything there for him to eat.
Maybe she'll think the storm blew me out to sea.
Do you want to risk your tail feathers on a maybe? A seagull, Uncle.
A seagull? He objected. But they're so stupid and so dirty.
You worried about dirt? Silk asked him, looking up. Silk had been busily counting on his fingers.
Don't push it, Kaldar, Belden growled ominously.
What day of the month was Prince Geryon born on? Silk asked Saenedra.
The 7th. Why?
We appear to have another one of those things that's setting out to make tomorrow very special. If I've counted right, tomorrow will be your son's 2nd birthday.
It can't be, she exclaimed. My baby was born in the winter time.
Saenedra, Geryon said gently. Riva's up near the top of the world. The reef is near the bottom. It is winter in Riva right now. Count up the months since Geryon was born. The time he spent with us before Zandramos stole him. The time we spent marching on Rehan. The trip to Prolgu, then to Tol Hanath, and on to Naissa, and all those other places where we had to stop. I think if you count rather closely, you will find that it has been very close to 2 years. She frowned, ticking the months off. Finally, her eyes went very wide.
I think he's right, she exclaimed. Geryon will be 2 years old tomorrow.
Durnick laid his hand on the little queen's arm.
I'll see if I can make something for you, to give as a present, Saenedra, he said gently. A boy ought to have a birthday present, after he's been separated from his family for so long.
Sinedra's eyes filled with tears.
Oh, Durnick,
she wept, embracing him.
You think of everything.
Geryon looked at Aunt Paul, his fingers moving slightly. Why don't you ladies take her in and put her to bed? He suggested. We are all through here, and if she thinks too much about this, she's going to get herself worked up. Tomorrow's going to be hard enough for her anyway. You might be right.
After the ladies had left, Geryon and the other men sat around the bolted-down table reminiscing. They covered in some detail the various adventures they had shared since that wind-tossed night so long ago when Geryon, Belgarath, Aunt Paul, and Durnick had crept out through the gate of Faldor's farm into the world, where the possible and the impossible inexorably merged. Again, Geryon felt that sense of cleansing, coupled with something else. It was as if, by recapitulating all that had happened in their long journey to the reef lying out there in the darkness, they were somehow bringing everything into focus to strengthen their resolve and their sense of purpose. It seemed to help, for some reason.
I think that's about enough of that, Belgorath said finally, rising to his feet. Now we all know what is behind us. It is time to pack all that away and start looking ahead. Let's get some sleep.
Synedra stirred restlessly when Garion slipped into bed.
I thought you were going to stay up all night, she said sleepily.
We were talking.
I know. I could hear the murmur of voices even in here. And men think women talk all the time.
Don't you?
Probably. But a woman can talk while her hands are busy. A man can't.
You might be right.
There was a moment of silence.
Garion?
She said.
Yes, Synedra?
Can I borrow your knife? The little dagger Durnick gave you when you were a boy?
If you want something cut, point it out. I'll cut it for you.
It's nothing like that, Garion. I just want to have a knife tomorrow.
What for?
As soon as I see Zandramas, I am going to kill her.
Synedra?
I have every right to kill her, Garion. You told Ceratus you did not think you could do it because Zandramas is a woman. I don't suffer from the same kind of delicacy as you do. I am going to carve out her heart, if she has one, slowly.
She said it with a fierceness he had never heard in her voice before.
I want blood, Garion. Lots of blood. And I want to hear her scream as I twist the knife in her. You will lend me your dagger, won't you?
Absolutely not.
That's all right, Garion,
she said in an icy tone.
I'm sure Lysel will lend me one of hers. Lysel is a woman. She knows how I feel.
Then she turned her back on him.
Synedra,
he said placatingly.
Yes?
Her tone was sulky.
Be reasonable, dear.
I don't want to be reasonable. I want to kill Zandramas.
I'm not going to let you put yourself in that kind of danger. We have much more important things to do tomorrow.
She sighed.
I suppose you're right. It's just...
Just what?
She turned back and put her arms around his neck.
Never mind, Garion,
she said.
Let's go to sleep now.
She nestled down against him, and after a few moments her regular breathing told him that she had drifted off.
You should have given her the knife,
the voice in his mind told him. Silk could have stolen it back from her sometime tomorrow.
But we've got something else to talk about, Garion. Have you been thinking about your successor?
Well, sort of. It doesn't really fit any of them, you know.
Have you given serious consideration to each of them?
I suppose I have. But I haven't been able to make any decisions yet.
You're not supposed to make your choice yet. All you had to do was think about each of them and get them all firmly fixed in your mind.
When do I make the choice, then?
At the last possible moment, Garion. Zandramas might be able to hear your thoughts, but she can't hear what you haven't decided yet.
What if I make a mistake?
I really don't think you can, Garion. I really don't.
Garion's sleep was troubled that night. His dreams seemed chaotic, disconnected. And he woke often only to sink back into a restless doze. There was at first a kind of distorted recapitulation of the strange dreams that had so disturbed him that night long ago on the Isle of Winds, just before his life had been unalterably changed. The question, are you ready? seemed to echo again and again in the vaults of his mind. Again he faced Rundurig with Aunt Paul's matter-of-fact instruction to kill his boyhood friend roaring in his mind. And then the boar he had encountered in the snowy wood outside Val Alorn was there, pawing at the snow, its eyes aglow with rage and hate.
"Are you ready?" Barak asked him before releasing the beast.
Then he stood on the colorless plain surrounded by the pieces of the incomprehensible game, trying to decide which piece to move, while the voice in his mind urged him to hurry. The dream subtly changed and took on a different tone. Our dreams, no matter how bizarre, have a familiarity to them, since they are formed and shaped by our own minds. Now it seemed as if Geryon's dreams were being formed by a different and unfriendly awareness, almost in the same way that Torak had intruded himself in dreams and in thoughts before the meeting at Tol Mishrak. Again he faced Asherak the Murgo in the loamy wood of the Dryads, and once again he unleashed his will with that single open-handed slap and the fatal word, "Burn." This was a familiar nightmare. It had haunted Geryon's sleep for years. He saw Asherak's cheek begin to seethe and smoke. He heard the Grolem shriek and saw him clutch at his burning face. He heard the dreadful plea,
"Master, have mercy."
He spurned that plea and intensified the flame. But this time the act was not overlaid with the sense of self-loathing that had always accompanied the dream, but a kind of cruel exultation, a hideous joy, as he watched his enemy writhe and burn before him. Deep within him something cried out, trying to repudiate that unholy joy. And then he was at Tol Mishrak, and his flaming sword slid again and again into the body of the one-eyed god. Torak's despairing,
"Mother!"
did not this time fill him with pity, but with a towering satisfaction. He felt himself laughing, and the savage, unpitying laughter erased his humanity. Soundlessly shrieking in horror, Geryon recoiled not so much from the awful images of those whom he had destroyed, but more from his own enjoyment of their despairing agony. Chapter 21. They were a somber group when they gathered in the main cabin before daybreak the following morning. With a sudden, even surprising insight, Geryon was very certain that the nightmares had not been his alone. Insight and intuitive perception were not normal for Geryon. His sensible, Sindarian background rejected such things as questionable, even in some peculiar way, immoral.
"Did you do that?" he asked the voice.
"No. Rather surprisingly, you came up with it all on your own. You seem to be making some progress. Slowly, of course, but progress all the same."
"Thanks. Don't mention it."
Silk looked particularly shaken as he entered the cabin. The little man's eyes were haunted and his hands were shaking. He slumped onto a bench and buried his face in his hands.
"Have you got any of that ale left?"
he asked Belden in a hoarse voice.
"A little quivery this morning, Keldar?" the dwarf asked him.
"No," Geryon said. "That's not what's bothering him. He had some bad dreams last night."
Silk raised his face sharply.
"How did you know that?" he demanded.
"I had some myself. I got to relive what I did to Asherak the Murgo. And I killed Torak again. Several times. It didn't get any better as we went along."
"I was trapped in a cave," Silk said with a shudder. "There wasn't any light, but I could feel the walls closing in on me. I think the next time I see Relg, I'm going to hit him in the mouth. Oh, gently, of course. Relg's sort of a friend."
"I'm glad I was not the only one," Zadi said.
The eunuch had placed a bowl of milk on the table, and Zith and her babies were gathered around it, lapping and purring. Geryon was a bit surprised to note that no one really paid any attention to Zith and her brood anymore. People, it seemed, could get used to almost anything. Tsadi rubbed his long-fingered hand over his shaved scalp. It seemed to me that I was adrift in the streets of Stithis Tor, and I was trying to survive by begging. It was ghastly.
Is Zandramas sacrificing my baby?
Tsinedra said in a stricken voice.
I was crying. It's so much blood. So very much blood.
Peculiar, Zakath said. I was presiding over a trial. I had to condemn a number of people. There was one of them I cared a great deal about, but I was forced to condemn her anyway.
I had one too,
Velvet admitted. I rather expect we all did, Geryon told them. The same thing happened to me on the way to Tol Mishrak. Torak kept intruding in my dreams.
He looked at Tsaradas.
Does the Child of Dark always fall back on this? He asked her. We have found that events keep repeating themselves when we are leading up to one of these meetings. Is this one of those events that keeps happening over and over again?
Thou art very perceptive, Belgerian of Riva,
the seeress told him.
In all the uncounted eons since these meetings began, thou art the first child of either light or dark to have realized that the sequence must be endlessly repeated until the division hath ended.
I'm not sure I can take much credit for it, Tsaradas. As I understand it, the meetings are getting closer and closer together. I'm probably the first in history to have been the child of light or dark during two meetings, and even then it took me a while to realize that it was happening. The nightmares are part of that pattern, then?
Thy guess is shrewd, Belgerian,
she smiled gently.
Unfortunately, it is not correct. It seemeth to me a shame to waste such a clever perception, though.
Are you trying to be funny, Holy Seeress?
Would I do that, noble Belgerian?
She said, perfectly imitating Silk's inflection.
You could spank her, Belden suggested.
With that human mountain standing guard over her? Geryon said, grinning at Toth. His eyes narrowed. You are not permitted to help us with this, are you, Tsaradas? He asked her. She sighed and shook her head. That's all right, Holy Seeress. I think we can come up with a workable answer to the question by ourselves.
He looked at Belgorath.
All right, he said. Torak tried to frighten me with nightmares, and now it looks as if Zandramas is trying to do the same thing, except that this time she's doing it to all of us. If it is not one of those usual repetitions, what is it?
That boy is beginning to develop a rather keen analytical mind, Belgorath, Belden said.
Naturally, the old man said modestly.
Don't wrench your shoulder out of its socket trying to pat yourself on the back, Belden said sourly.
He rose to his feet and started pacing up and down. His forehead creased in thought.
Now then, he began. First, this is not just one of those tedious repetitions that have been dogging us since the beginning, right?
Right, Belgorath agreed.
Second, it happened in about the same way last time.
He looked at Geryon.
Right?
He asked.
Right,
Geryon said.
That's only two times. Twice can be a coincidence. But let's assume that it's not. We know that the Child of Light always has companions, but that the Child of Dark is always solitary.
So Tsaradas tells us, Belgorath agreed.
She doesn't have any reason to lie to us. All right, if the Child of Light has companions, but the Child of Dark is alone, wouldn't that put the Dark at a serious disadvantage?
You would think so.
But the two have always been so evenly matched that not even the gods can predict the outcome. The Child of Dark is using something to offset the apparent advantage of our side. I think these nightmares might be part of it.
Silk rose and came over to Garion.
Discussions like this make my head ache, he said quietly. I'm going up on deck for a while.
He left the cabin, and for no apparent reason, the gangly young wolf followed him.
I don't really think a few nightmares would make that much difference, Belden,
Belgarath disagreed. But what if the nightmares are only a part of it, old wolf?
Poledra asked him.
You and Paul were both at Vomimbre, and that was one of these meetings, too. You two have been companions of the Child of Light twice already. What happened at Vomimbre?
We did have nightmares,
Belgarath conceded to Belden.
Anything else? The dwarf asked intently.
We saw things that were not there, but that could have come from all of the Grolems in the vicinity.
And?
Everybody went sort of crazy. It was all we could do to keep Brand from trying to attack Torak with his teeth. And at Tor Mishrak, I entombed Belzadar in solid rock. And then Paul wanted to dig him up so that she could drink his blood.
Father, I did not, she objected.
Oh, really? You were very angry that day, Paul.
It fits the same pattern, old wolf, Poledra said somberly. Our side fights with normal weapons. Garion's sword might be a little abnormal, but it is still just a sword.
You would not say that if you had been at Tor Mishrak, her husband told her.
I was there, Belgarath, she replied.
You were?
Of course. I was hiding in the ruins watching. Anyway, the Child of Dark does not attack the body. It attacks the mind. That's how it manages to keep everything so perfectly balanced. Nightmares, hallucinations, and ultimately madness, Polgara mused. That is a formidable array of things to throw against us. It might even have worked, if Sandramos had not been so clumsy.
I don't quite follow that, Paul, Durnick said.
She blundered, Polgara shrugged. If only one person has a nightmare, he will probably try to shrug it off, and he certainly won't mention it on the morning of the meeting. Zandramos sent nightmares to all of us, though. This conversation probably would not have taken place if she hadn't.
It's nice to know that she can stumble, too, Belgarath said. All right, then. We know that she has been tampering with us. The best way to defeat that tactic is to put those nightmares out of our minds.
And to be particularly wary if we start seeing things that should not be there, Polgara added.
Silk and the wolf came back down the stairs to the cabin.
We've got absolutely beautiful weather this morning, he reported happily, bending slightly to scratch the pup's ears.
"Wonderful," Zadi murmured dryly.
Zadi was carefully anointing his small dagger with a fresh coating of poison. He was wearing a stout leather jerkin and leather boots that reached to mid-thigh. Back in Stithi's store, Zadi had appeared, despite his slender frame, to be soft, even in some peculiar way, flabby. Now, however, he looked lean and tough. A year or more without drugs, and with an enforced regimen of hard exercise, had changed him a great deal.
It is perfect, Silk told him. We have fog this morning, ladies and gentlemen. A nice, wet, gray fog, almost thick enough to walk on. That fog would be a burglar's delight.
Trust Silk to think of that, Durnick smiled.
The smith wore his usual clothing,
but he had given Toth his axe while he himself carried the dreadful sledge with which he had driven off the demon, Nahaz.
"The prophecies are leading us around by the noses again," Belden said irritably. "But at least it appears that we made the right decision last night. A good thick fog makes sneaking almost inevitable."
Belden looked the same as always, tattered, dirty, and very ugly.
"Maybe they're just trying to help,"
Velvet suggested. Velvet had shocked them all when she had entered the cabin a half hour earlier. She wore tight-fitting leather clothing, not unlike that normally worn by the Nadrak dancer Vela. It was a peculiarly masculine garb and bleakly businesslike.
"They've done a great deal to assist Zandramas. Maybe it is our turn to get a little help." "Is she right?"
Geryon asked the awareness that shared his mind. "Are you and your opposite helping us for a change?"
"Oh, don't be silly, Geryon. Nobody's been helping anybody. That's forbidden at this particular stage of the game."
"Where did the fog come from, then?"
"Where does fog usually come from?"
"How would I know?"
"I didn't think so. Ask Belden. He can probably tell you. The fog out there is perfectly natural."
"Lysel,"
Geryon said,
"I was just checking with my friend. The fog isn't the result of any playing around. It's a natural result of the storm."
"How disappointing,"
she said. Tenedra had risen that morning fully intent on wearing a dryad tunic. Geryon had adamantly rejected that idea, however. She wore instead a simple gray wool dress with no petticoats to hinder her movements. She was quite obviously stripped down for action. Geryon was fairly certain that she had at least one knife concealed somewhere in her clothing.
"Why don't we get started?"
she demanded.
"Because it is still dark, dear,"
Polgara explained patiently.
"We have to wait for at least a little bit of light."
Polgara and her mother wore almost identical plain dresses, Polgara's gray and Poledra's brown.
"Geryon,"
Poledra said then,
"why don't you step down to the galley and tell them that we will have breakfast now? We should all eat something, since I doubt that we'll have time or maybe even the need for lunch."
Poledra sat at Belgoroth's side, and the two of them were almost unconsciously holding hands. Geryon was a bit offended at her suggestion. He was a king, after all, not an errand boy. Then he realized just how silly that particular thought was. He started to rise.
"I'll go, Geryon,"
Eriand said. It was almost as if the blonde young man had seen into his friend's thoughts. Eriand wore the same simple brown peasant clothes he always wore, and he had nothing even resembling a weapon. As the young man went out through the cabin door, Geryon had an odd thought. Why was he paying so much attention to the appearance of each of his companions? He had seen them all before. And for the most part, he had seen the clothing they wore this morning so many times that the garments should not even have registered on his mind. Then, with dreadful certainty, he knew. One of them was going to die today. And he was fixing them all in his mind so that he could remember for the rest of his life the one who was to make that sacrifice. He looked at Zakath. His Malorian friend had shaved off his short beard. His slightly olive skin was no longer pale, but tanned and healthy-looking, save for the now lighter patch on his chin and jaw. He wore simple clothing, much like Geryon's own, since as soon as they reached the reef, the two of them would be putting on their armor. Toth, his face impassive, was dressed as always, a loincloth, sandals, and that unbleached wool blanket slung across one shoulder. He did not, however, have his heavy staff. Instead, Durnik's axe lay in his lap. The seeress of Kel was unchanged, Her hooded white robe gleamed, and her blindfold, unwrinkled and unchanged, smoothly covered her eyes. Idly, Garrigan wondered if she removed the cloth when she slept. A chilling thought came to him then. What if the one they would lose today was going to be Ceradus? She had sacrificed everything for her task. Surely the two prophecies could not be so cruel as to require one last supreme sacrifice from this slender girl. Belgrath, of course, was unchanged and unchangeable. He still wore the mismatched boots, patched hose, and rust-colored tunic he had worn when he had appeared at Faldor's farm as Mr. Wolf, the storyteller. The one difference about the old man was the fact that he did not hold a tankard in his free hand. At supper the previous evening, he had almost absently drawn himself one that brimmed with foaming ale. Poledra, just as absently, had firmly removed it from his hand and had emptied it out a porthole. Garrion strongly suspected that Belgarath's drinking days had come rather abruptly to an end. He decided that it might be refreshing to have a long conversation with his grandfather when the old man was completely sober. They ate their breakfast with hardly any conversation, since there was nothing more to say. Cinedra dutifully fed the puppy, then looked rather sadly at Garrion.
"Take care of him, please," she said.
There was no point in arguing with her on that score. The idea that she would not survive this day was so firmly fixed in her mind that no amount of talking would erase it.
"You might want to give him to Garen," she added. "Every boy should have a dog, and caring for him will teach our son responsibility."
"I never had a dog," Garrion said.
"That was unkind of you, Aunt Paul,"
Cinedra said, lapsing unconsciously, or perhaps not, into that form of address.
"He would not have had time to look after one, Cinedra. Our Garrion has had a very busy life."
"Let's hope that it gets less so when this is all over," Garrion said. After they had eaten, Captain Kreska entered the cabin carrying a map.
"This isn't very precise," he apologized. "As I said last night, I was never able to take very accurate soundings around that peak. We can inch our way to within a few hundred yards of the beach, and then we'll have to take the longboat. This fog is going to make it even more complicated, I'm afraid."
"Is there a beach along the east side of the peak?" Belgrath asked him.
"A very shallow one," Kreska replied. "The neap tide should expose a bit more of it, though."
"Good. There are a few things we will need to take ashore with us."
Belgrath pointed at the two stout canvas bags holding the armor Garrion and Zakath would wear.
"I'll have some men stow them in the boat for you."
"When can we get started?"
Cinedra asked impatiently.
"Another 20 minutes or so, little lady."
"So long?"
He nodded.
"Unless you can figure out a way to make the sun come up early."
Cinedra looked quickly at Belgrath.
"Never mind," he told her.
"Captain," Poledra said, "could you have someone look after our pet?"
She pointed at the wolf.
"He is a bit over-enthusiastic sometimes, and we wouldn't want him to start howling at the wrong time."
"Of course, lady."
Kreska, it appeared, had not spent enough time ashore to recognize a wolf when he saw one. Inching proved to be a very tedious process. The sailors raised the anchors and then manned the oars. After every couple of strokes, they paused while a man in the bow heaved out the lead-weighted sounding line.
"It is slow," Silk observed in a low voice, as they all stood on deck. "But at least it is quiet. We don't know who is on that reef, and I would rather not alert them."
"It's shoaling, Captain,"
the man with the sounding line reported, his voice no louder than absolutely necessary. The obviously warlike preparations of Garrion and his friends had stressed the need for quiet, louder than any words. The sailor cast out his line again.
There was that interminable-seeming wait while the ship drifted up over the weighted line.
"The bottom is coming up fast, Captain," the sounder said then. "I make it 2 fathoms.
"Back your oars," Kreska commanded his crew in a low voice. "Drop the hook. This is as close as we can go."
He turned to his mate.
"After we get away in the longboat, back out about another 100 yards and anchor there. We'll whistle when we come back, the usual signal. Guide us in."
"Aye, aye, Captain."
"I see you've done this before," Silk said to Kreska. "A few times, yes," Kreska admitted.
"If all goes well today, you and I might want to have a little talk. I have a business proposition that I think might interest you."
"Is that all you ever think about?"
Velvet asked him.
"Missed opportunity is gone forever, my dear Lizelle," he replied with a certain pomposity.
"You are incorrigible."
"I suppose you could say that, yes."
An oil-soaked wad of burlap in the hawse hole muffled the rattling of the anchor chain as the heavy iron hook sank down through the dark water. Geryon felt, rather than heard, the grating of the points of the anchor on the rocks lying beneath the heavy swells.
"Let's board the longboat," Kreska said. "The crew will lower her after we are all on board."
He looked apologetically at them.
"I am afraid you and your friends are going to have to help with the rowing, Geryon. The longboat only holds so many people."
"Of course, Captain."
"I'll come along to make sure you get ashore safely."
"Captain," Belgareth said then, "once we are ashore, stand your ship out to sea a ways. We will signal you when we are ready to be picked up."
"All right."
"If you do not see a signal by tomorrow morning, you might as well go on back to Perivor, because we won't be coming back."
Kreska's face was solemn.
"Is whatever it is you are planning to do on that reef really that dangerous?" he asked.
"Probably even more so," Silk told him. "We've all been trying very hard not to think about it."
It was eerie, rowing across the oily-seeming black water with the grayish tendrils of fog rising from the heavy swells. Geryon was suddenly reminded of that foggy night in Stithistor when they had crossed the River of the Serpent, with only the unerring sense of direction of the one-eyed assassin Isis to guide them. Idly as he rowed, Geryon wondered what had ever happened to Isis. After every 10 strokes or so, Captain Kreska, who stood in the stern at the tiller, signaled for them to stop. He cocked his head, listening to the sound of the surf.
"Another couple 100 yards now," he said in a low voice. "You there," he said to the sailor in the bow, who held another sounding line. "Keep busy with that lead. I don't want to hit any rocks. Sing out if it starts shoaling."
"Aye, aye, Captain."
The longboat crept on through the dark and fog toward the unseen beach where the long wash and slither of the waves on graveled shingle made that peculiar grating sound as each wave lifted pebbles from the beach to carry them up to the very verge of land and then, with melancholy and regretful note, to draw them back again, as if the ever-hungry sea mourned its inability to engulf the land and turn all the world into one endless ocean where huge waves, unimpeded, could roll thrice around the globe. The heavy fog bank lying to the east began to turn lighter and lighter as dawn broke over the dark, mist-obscured waves.
"Another 100 yards, Kreska said tensely.
"When we get there, Captain," Belgarath said to him, "keep your men in the boat. They won't be permitted to land anyway, and they had better not try. We will push you back out as soon as we get ashore."
Kreska swallowed hard and nodded. Geryon could hear the surf more clearly now and catch the seaweed-rank smell of the meeting of sea and land. Then, just before he was able to make out the dark line of the beach through the obscuring fog, the heavy, dangerous swells flattened, and the sea around the longboat became as flat and slick as a pane of glass.
That was accommodating of them, Silk observed.
Shh,
Velvet told him, laying one finger to her lips.
I'm trying to listen.
The bow of the longboat grated on the gravel strand, and Durnick stepped out of the boat and drew it farther up onto the pebbles. Garion and his friends also stepped out into the ankle-deep water and waded ashore.
We'll see you tomorrow morning, Captain,
Garion said quietly, as Toth prepared to push the boat back out.
I hope,
he added.
Good luck, Garion, Kreska said. After we are all back on board, you'll have to tell me what this was all about.
I may want to forget about it by then, Garion said ruefully.
Not if you win,
Kreska's voice came back out of the fog.
I like that man, Silk said.
He's got a nice, optimistic attitude.
Let's get off this open beach, Belgareth said. In spite of what Garion's friend told him, I sense a certain tenuousness about this fog. I'll feel a lot better if we have got some rocks to hide behind.
Durnick and Toth picked up the two canvas bags containing the armor, and Garion and Zakath drew their swords and led the way up from the gravel strand. The mountain they approached seemed composed of speckled granite, fractured into unnatural blocks. Garion had seen enough granite and the mountains here and there around the world to know that the stone usually crumbled and weathered into rounded shapes.
Strange, Durnick murmured,
kicking with one still wet boot at the perfectly squared-off edge of one of the blocks. He lowered the canvas bag and drew his knife. He dug for a moment at the rock with his knife point.
It's not granite, he said quietly. Well, it looks like granite, but it's much too hard. It's something else.
We can identify it later, Belden told him. Let's find some cover just in case Belgarath's suspicion turns out to be accurate. As soon as we get settled, I'll drift around the peak a few times.
You won't be able to see anything, Silk predicted.
I'll be able to hear, though.
Over there, Durnick said, pointing with his sledge. It looks as if one of these blocks got dislodged and rolled down to the beach. There's a fairly large niche there.
Good enough for now, Belgareth said. Belden, when you make the change, do it very slowly. I am sure Xandramos landed at almost the exact same time we did, and she will hear you.
I know how it's done, Belgareth.
The niche in the side of the strange, stair-stepped peak was more than large enough to conceal them, and they moved down into it cautiously.
Neat, Silk said.
Why don't you all wait here and catch your breath? Belden can turn into a seagull and go have a look around the island. I'll go on ahead and pick out a trail for us.
Be careful, Belgareth told him.
Someday. You're going to forget to say that, Belgareth. And it will probably wither every tree on earth.
The little man climbed back up out of the niche and disappeared into the fog.
You do say that to him a lot, you know, Belden said to Belgareth.
Silk is an enthusiast. He needs frequent reminding. Did you plan to leave sometime during the next hour?
Belden spat out a very unflattering epithet, shimmered very slowly, and sailed away.
Your temper has not improved much, old wolf, Poledra said to him.
Did you think it might have?
Not really, she replied. But there's always room for hope.
Despite Belgareth's premonition, the fog hung on. After about a half hour, Belden returned.
Somebody has landed on the west beach, he reported. I couldn't see them, but I could certainly hear them. Angorax seemed to have some trouble keeping their voices down. Sorry, Zakath, but it's the truth.
I'll issue an imperial command that the next 3 or 4 generations converse in whispers, if you would like.
No, that's all right, Zakath, the dwarf grinned. As long as I'm on the opposite side from at least some Angorax, I like to be able to hear them coming. Did Keldar make it back yet?
Not yet, Garion told him.
What's he doing? These stone blocks are much too big to steal.
Then Silk slipped over the edge of the niche and dropped lightly to the stone floor.
You're not going to believe this, he said.
Probably not, Velvet said. But why don't you go ahead and tell us anyway?
This peak is man-made, or at least something made it. These blocks encircle it like terraces, all straight and smooth. The thing forms steps up to that flat place on top. There's an altar up there and a huge throne.
So that's what it meant, Belden exclaimed, snapping his fingers. Belgarath, have you ever read the Book of Torak?
I have struggled through it a few times. My old Engrak isn't really all that good.
You can speak old Engrak?
Zakath asked with some surprise.
It is a forbidden language here in Meloria. I suspect Torak was changing a few things, and he did not want anyone to catch him at it.
I learned it before the Prohibition went into effect. What is the point of this, Belden?
Do you remember that passage near the beginning? In the middle of all that conceited blather, when Torak said he went up into the high places of Khorim to argue with Ull about the creation of the world?
Vaguely.
Anyway, Ull didn't want anything to do with it. So Torak turned his back on his father and went down and gathered up the Angoraks and led them back to Khorim. He told them what he had in mind for them, and then in true Angorak fashion, they fell down on their faces and started butchering each other as sacrifices. There's a word in that passage, Halagachak. It means temple or something like that. I always thought that Torak was speaking figuratively, but he wasn't. This peak is that temple. The altar up there more or less confirms it, and these terraces were where the Angorak stood to watch while the Grolems sacrificed people to their god. If I'm right, this is also the place where Torak spoke with his father. Regardless of how you feel about old Burnt Face, this is one of the holiest places on Earth.
You keep talking about Torak's father, Zakath said, looking puzzled. He did not know that the gods had fathers.
Of course they do, Zinedra said loftily. Everybody knows that.
I didn't.
Ull is their father,
she said in a deliberately offhand manner.
Isn't he the god of the Ulgos?
Not by choice, exactly, Belgarath told him. The original Gorim more or less bullied him into it.
How do you bully a god?
Carefully, Belden said. Very, very carefully.
I have met Ull,
Zinedra supplied gratuitously.
He sort of likes me.
She can be very irritating at times, can't she?
Zakath said to Geryon.
You have noticed?
You don't have to like me,
she said with a toss of her curls.
Either one of you. As long as the gods like a girl, she'll do all right.